Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We've all done this. You're talking with someone and suddenly all you can think about is, does she like what I'm wearing? Does he like me? What is that person over there thinking about? Our ability to think about what's going on inside other people's heads is so innate, most of us probably don't question it. But Laurie Santos does. She's a professor of psychology at Yale University, director of the Comparative Cognition Laboratory, as well as the Canine Cognition Center. Laurie, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. I have to admit, I kind of feel like I'm standing on the edge of a whirlpool and about to like jump into a never-ending self-referential spiral here, thinking about my thoughts and somebody else's thought. But the whole concept of a mind as opposed to a brain, I mean, they're linked, but they're a little bit different, right? The mind is this abstract. It's all the thoughts. And then the thought of actually thinking, I have a mind. I mean, it's kind of the age-old, I think, therefore I am. It seems like this whole idea of thinking that you have a mind is really inextricably linked to the pure idea of consciousness.
Yeah, it's really tricky. I mean, on the one hand, it sounds so philosophical, right? You know, you're standing on the edge of the whirlpool. It gets really scary. But on the other hand, it's just super simple. I mean, the crazy thing about humans is that when we think about other people's behavior, when we're trying to predict how people are going to act, we don't make reference to their behavior, right? If I'm trying to predict what somebody's thinking, I'm not thinking about like where they're looking or what they're about to do. I'm thinking about what's going on inside their head, you know, their intentions, their beliefs, their desires, all these things. And the crazy thing is we don't ever have evidence of that stuff, right? They're just concepts that are inside somebody's head. Nobody taught you about somebody's beliefs or their intentions. It's just this really natural way that we make sense of behavior. So on the one hand, it seems kind of crazy postulating about what's going on in people's mind or mind reading. But on the other hand, it's just the really simple way that we try to make sense of somebody's behavior. It's just the kind of innate way that we go about making sense of the social world.
Well, and as you say, it's innate and it's pretty universal, but there are definitely variations. And some mental health problems or neurological problems are actually linked to or involved with not being able to conceptualize what other people are thinking or feeling or other people's mental states as well.
That's correct. I mean, reading somebody's mind and thinking in terms of somebody's mental states is really a hallmark of being a neurotypical individual. You have individuals who have autism or on the spectrum who have a tougher time kind of reasoning about what other people are thinking. Sometimes you see other syndromes like schizophrenia where people do that too much, right? They're overthinking what's going on inside somebody's head almost to the point of paranoia. So there's kind of a nice sweet spot for us neurotypical folks in terms of how we think about other minds, which is telling that for most people, there's kind of the way that we tend to do it, and you can kind of go too much or too little.
And is it something that happens just from the time we're born, or is this something that we have to learn and pick up over time?
It's a great question. In fact, it's a question that developmental psychologists are studying right now. On the one hand, it seems so natural that that's the way we make sense of the world. On the other hand, it's pretty complicated, right? Like thinking that somebody else has a different belief than you do seems kind of, you know, like a complicated thing that you need a really rich mind for. And what developmental researchers are learning is that there seems to be some development in terms of our thinking about other minds. It does get better over the course of the first few years of life, interestingly. But even from infancy, even within the first year of life, babies are already reasoning about people's intentions, their actions. They're already thinking as though other people have a mind, even when they're within the first year of life. Like, they're not even crawling around yet, but they're watching their mom's actions, thinking of it in terms of intentions and desires.
You've been asking this, how long has this been around in a grander sense, in terms of when did it show up in an evolutionary sense?
That's right.
Why do you think it's important to understand when this ability to think about other people's minds arose?
Well, it's important, I think, to understand how the weird things that we do as humans arose naturally, right? We're a really strange species, right? We're here using language. We think about what's going on inside other people's heads. Like, it's not clear if we're the only species out there that does that. And lots of psychologists have thought that this ability to read other people's minds, that might be the thing that makes us special. And so trying to see whether other species have something like that can really tell us about this big question of what does it mean to be human? What is it that it makes us special? And so that's why we've turned to our closest living relatives, non-human primates. They're kind of our best test case for where our human abilities came from. And we've been trying to study whether or not they think about other minds too.
And what have you found out so far? And I'm really curious how you figure out
Yes.
what you figured out so far, because, of course, we all know what's going on inside our own heads. So researchers know from their own personal experience, your own personal Yep. experience, that you do this. and we can ask each other about it, but how do you get any information from a primate who can't talk to you and tell you, hey, I think you're thinking this right now?
Yeah, that's the main methodological problem with our science. It'd be so much easier if they could just tell us, you know. Sadly, they can't. Well, the good news is that we use what other people are thinking all the time and in all kinds of contexts. And so we can just put monkeys, say, into a context where we might be using what other people think. And one of those common contexts is the context of deception. So one way that I could try to steal something from you if I was being really crafty is to pay attention to what you're paying attention to. You know, if I was trying to steal a pencil out of your hand or something, it might not work if you were looking at me when I did it, right? It helped me to try to...
So it's the, hey, look over there, and I'm going to grab the thing in front of you.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a, like, crafty salesman approach. But we can do exactly that with the monkeys. We have a population of field-living monkeys that live on an island in Puerto Rico. They're really habituated to humans, and they're often really interested in taking the kind of delicious treats that we have around us, right? You know, our sandwiches and our lunches and so on. And so we can just give monkeys the opportunity to do that. Really simply, we find a monkey who's by themselves, we put a tasty treat down, and we either pay attention to that treat or we look away. And we try to look at whether the monkey's rates of stealing are higher in that case where we're not paying attention. And lo and behold, what we find is that the monkeys are pretty good at this. They tend to steal more when we're not paying attention, when we're not looking. They tend to steal more when there's some food or something we don't know about. It seems like they're tracking some information about what we know and what we don't know.
That's monkeys, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, all you have to do, of course, is look at chimpanzees, and you can see the very clear resemblance and the behavioral similarities to us. But you mentioned language a few minutes ago, and there's also some idea that theory of mind is related maybe to language.
That's right.
And what immediately occurred to me is, well, there are species like, say, dolphins or whales that certainly communicate vocally with each other, that we think of as being very intelligent, and in some cases seeming to understand things like a human is in distress. Is it possible that this theory of mind goes back way farther than primates and humans?
Yeah, well, we're just now starting to test these more distantly related species. One group that researchers have looked at a lot, in fact, is birds. Another species that you might not necessarily think of as smart, but if you look at the size of their brain relative to their bodies, at least some groups of birds, like corvids, are really
not really fair to call them bird brains.
Exactly. And it turns out that they're also quite good at this. You can put birds in exactly the same sort of scenarios. Species like raven and so on have been tested like this. And it turns out they're just as good at primates on these kinds of tasks. So the truth is that we don't know too much yet. There's not that many species that have been tested. But there's hints that at least that simple thing, paying attention to what somebody else is paying attention to, that might be the kind of thing that lots of social species from a bunch of taxonomic groups share with humans.
Well, I have to say the other thing, just in reading where you work and the canine cognition lab, and I couldn't help but I had to laugh out loud because the first thing that popped into my mind was these cartoons where we're imagining what's inside a dog's head. And of course, what we imagine inside a dog's head is a dog thinking about what's my owner thinking about. So we're assigning this property to animals all around us, whether or not we have any idea if dogs actually can read human minds in that way.
That's right. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're so excited to do the science on this, right? We have such strong intuitions about what animals are thinking about, particularly our pets. Our companion animals are so important to us. But oftentimes we're just relying on our intuitions. And sometimes those intuitions are dead on. You know, oftentimes we're correct about what our animals are thinking about. But sometimes we're not so on. And that's why we need the science to really test these kinds of things.
If this is such a pervasive feature of our own minds, and we're projecting it onto animals all around us, how do you correct for that in your research, or make sure that you're not just seeing what you want to see, what you think they're thinking?
It's really tricky. One thing that we do is we often rely on dependent measures that make the animals act in some way, right? So it's not just kind of us thinking about what they're doing. We really want to see them take a certain behavior. And sometimes when we do that, we realize that our intuitions were dead wrong. So there's one recent study trying to see whether or not dogs feel regret about their actions. You know, every dog owner has come home and seen the dog kind of looking guilty and realize
tail, like, hanging, yeah, ears hanging.
Something, the dog got into something, you know. But are they showing those behaviors because they really feel bad? That's our intuition. Or are they doing it for some other reason. And so Alexandra Horowitz and her colleague, she's a professor at Barnard College, did a study to test this. And so they gave dogs a tempting thing that they weren't supposed to do. They put some food down and told a dog, don't take it, don't take it. And then they left the room. And so dogs did one of two things. They either, you know, did the naughty thing or not. But the neat thing was that Horowitz told the dog's owners either that the dog did the good thing or the bad thing, irrespective of what the dog actually did. And so the owner comes in either thinking the dog did something good or not. And the question is, what controls whether or not the dogs are acting guilty? And what you find is that what the dogs actually did doesn't matter at all for whether or not they show the guilty behaviors. The guilty ones and the not so guilty ones acted exactly the same. What does seem to matter is how we react. So when the dog's companion comes in and is really happy, like, you did such a good job, no guilty behaviors, even for dogs that actually did the bad thing. But when the dog's companion comes in and is like, you know, Fluffy, like, why'd you do it? All of a sudden, guilty behaviors come on.
Wow.
And so what this is telling us is that our intuition about what they're feeling, that they're feeling guilty over what they actually did, just doesn't seem to map onto what's happening. What they're feeling guilty for is maybe our reaction, but it's a little bit different than our intuition. I think this is a nice way to highlight what's important about some of these studies is, yes, sometimes our intuitions are dead on, but sometimes we're getting it wrong. And particularly for our companion animals, it's important to understand what's really going on in their heads. You know, that's how we make them happy and healthy and so on.
I've had neurobiologists who are studying the structure of the brain and how the brain physically and electrically is working say, this is the century of the brain. We are going to unlock all of the secrets of the brain. And from that physical electrical structure, we're going to figure out all of these abstract phenomena. Do you think that's possible, or do we have to be studying it as you are at the whole person, whole animal level to really understand what's going on in the brain?
Yeah, I think it's important to do both. I mean, understanding the physical structure can really constrain what we're thinking about. Say, if we find that primates share a very particular brain structure that we use for language, you know, that's going to give us some hints about whether or not they share that ability or not. But really, just understanding the structures can sometimes not tell us all that we need to know. Of course, we know that our iPhones and our smart tablets and so on, all those things are really, really smart, even though the hardware that they use is completely different. You can run really smart programs on hardware that looks really different from the human brain. And so we need to both know a little bit about the programs and the algorithms being used at the same time as we understand the brain or the hardware.
Lori Santos is a professor of psychology at Yale University, director of the Comparative Cognition Laboratory and the Canine Cognition Center. And I'm going to try not to think about what you're thinking about right now and just say thank you for a really fun conversation.
Thanks so much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can always find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.